PT Final Exam is an awesome resource for students preparing to take the National Physical Therapy Exam. Visit them online at ptfinalexam.com/pintcast. That's ptfinalexam.com/pintcast.
This is the PT Pintcast, a podcast that talks about physical therapy over beer. Bringing together clinicians, researchers, and forward-thinking PTs in a show that's anything but boring.
Let there be beer!
This is the PT Pintcast with your host, Jimmy McKay.
The next episode of the PT Pintcast starts right now. The best conversations happen at happy hour. Welcome to ours. Our guest tonight is one of the few CFA charter holders in the world that has experience in wealth management and valuation. I think that has something to do with numbers. He's using those skills and experiences to develop new financial technology and financial products for the PT industry, primarily because his wife's a PT, and he's seen firsthand how their technology can really help the field. The name of the company is Fitbucks, and on the show tonight, Joseph Ranke. Joe, welcome to the show, my man.
Thanks for having me, Jimmy. I'm glad to be here. Hopefully, we can touch on a subject that can help a lot of different people and is on the top of minds, especially for all those new grads that are starting to enter the field.
It's icky, and we keep it under the bed for so long. We don't want to open that email when we see what our debt is going to be, and we just ignore it. We bury our head in
the sand. Just hit delete when that email comes in.
First question is always the hardest. Are we drinking today?
I'm drinking. I mean, unfortunately, a couple years ago, one of the worst days of my life, I found out I developed an allergy to beer. So I'll have some Jack Daniels over here on the side.
That's
ready
legit.
To go.
That's we do not discourage hard alcohol use on the show as well. I like to have a different beer with each episode. Today, because it's really, really hot where I am on the East Coast, we're approaching 100 degrees. I went with a Shandy because it's fruity. This is from Traveler. It's the Traveler Grapefruit Shandy. So cheers to you, my friend.
Yeah, cheers.
All right. So I am admittedly the least savvy when it comes to anything loans. I pretty much just sign at the bottom. I don't know what I'm doing. As long as where I sign will get me into the school I want to go to, and then eventually I'm going to have to pay the bill. It's kind of like just ordering whatever you want off the menu. Yeah, I want this and this and this. And then when the bill comes, you're like, yeah, I guess I owe that. But in the meantime, if you relate that to school, that doesn't necessarily have to be the case. Where are we in terms of, oh my God, I'm about to graduate and be done with PT school in 13 days, which is where I am right now. Should I be panicking now? Is it too late for me, or do I still have some options?
First of all, never panic. You know, I like to go throughout the entire finance, throughout your entire life, whether it be student loans, investing, whatever, just keeping it simple. Okay, I learned that lesson when I was really young, and then going through college, one of our professors used to say, it's the KISS method. Keep it simple, stupid.
I like it.
So when you look at it that way, and you start developing your strategies of how you pay this off, you know, now's a good time to start. The sooner the better, obviously, just because you have a thought process of how you strategize around it. So if you're a student, you can start strategizing. If today is the first day you strategize, great. If you wait till 5 years from now to start strategizing, then you're going to start putting yourself behind the eight ball at that point.
Well, let's start from student loans while in school. How can you develop a strategy? Because I know a lot of my classmates and myself included, our strategy was keep signing on the dotted line. Watch the number get bigger, and then eventually I'll figure it out, I guess. But what can you do maybe before school or while you're in school to maybe set yourself up to be in a better position when you get out?
The first thing is just to understand what the options are when you graduate. And what that means is, first and foremost, saying, okay, well, I don't have any income today because I don't have to, therefore I don't have to set a budget. Understand that when you graduate, say, okay, well, I'll make about $70,000 a year or whatever that is, and develop a hypothetical budget. And again, just keep it really, really, really simple. Income minus expenses, that's how much money I'm going to have left over. And then you can kind of start to see where you're at in terms of, okay, based on this much loan, I'm going to have to qualify for something like IBR, or I'm going to be able to prepay my loan.
I have no idea what IBR is. Talk to me like I'm a stupid PT student. All right, okay.
We will go over what the IDR plans are from the government and whatnot. What that does is it now allows you to say, okay, I know I'm going to be able to prepay these loans when I graduate and pay them out aggressively. Therefore, while I'm in school, I can start making some payments, and that's going to save me a lot of money over time. Or if you understand that strategy now and you say, well, I'm going to have to qualify for public service loan forgiveness because I have a really large loan amount. Well, while you're a first year, a second year, a third year student, now all your clinicals, all your networking, everything you're doing is being geared towards getting a nonprofit job or a government job so that way you can qualify for that program.
Right, and that's a big topic with students, that there's this mystical thing out there, the student loan forgiveness, where eventually Uncle Sam comes in and says, you know what, all that debt, you did something good for us, we'll just throw that out. So I feel like we're our own worst enemies in terms of students, because when you get on Twitter or Facebook, everybody keeps talking about these programs as if they know the entire story, and I think they're not doing it on purpose. We just hear about this unicorn, this loan forgiveness program. So talk about that a little bit. You're bringing it up, which means it's actually real.
Yeah, and like you said, it is kind of a unicorn. It's not that simple. You know, one of the biggest things that you touch on it the most is when you go on Twitter or social media. You know, I always joke around that the internet was great because it gives everybody a voice, but it's also really bad because it gives everybody a voice. So the problem with that is when you go on there and people are like, oh, you're stupid if you do that, or you're stupid if you do this. And it's like, that's not really the case. On a different subject, I actually had somebody ask me a question on Quora the other day that said, I graduated with no debt. I have $100,000 in cash. How should I start investing it? And you should see the answers. People are giving them like allocation answers. It's like you don't even know this person.
Right. I got a podcast they could sponsor just if you still have that guy's email or whatever.
Exactly.
But you're right. People like to say they understand the whole picture, even on the internet, when you only have a small piece.
Yeah, exactly. And that's part of where our technology comes in, and what we're developing is to get your entire background so we can easily explain to you, if you make this choice, this is the repercussion. If you make this choice, that's a repercussion. And so when you talk about the income-driven repayment plans, so if you don't know what those are, basically when you graduate, the government now has five different options that it's based as a percentage of your income, and that's how your repayments are determined. Oftentimes, it's a lot less than what you would actually owe on a typical 10-year principal and interest loan.
So by going through this, you're going to actually save yourself some money by paying less over time.
Potentially.
You got to keep it slow for me. I got a D+ in math.
Yeah, and hypothetically, that's the theory behind it. But what people don't know is that on an IDR plan, after 20 or 25 years, you actually owe money still. So the principal balance on what you owe doesn't go down. It can actually go up on how much you owe. So for example, if you have your PT Pinecast and you actually end up doing, generating a lot of revenue from it, and you're showing that as income, you might not qualify for income-driven repayment plans anymore.
Good thing we don't make any money here. We just pay.
That's one of the major issues with it is that it's not a loan, okay? It's a repayment plan, meaning you have to qualify for it every single year. And so if the government decides to change the terms of those qualifications midstream, they can do so. Now, the reality of them doing that, I don't know. Nobody can say. Were they grandfather people in? Who knows?
So I mean, there's a risk.
Yes, there's a risk of uncertainty. That's the risk you're taking. And then at the end of the 20th year, let's say, when they forgive your loan, whatever principal balance you owe at that time, it goes on your tax return as income. So you now owe taxes on that. So that is one of the biggest pieces that nobody ever talks about. I've actually even heard one student say to me, well, by that time, they'll change the law. That law also...
That's a gutsy bet.
Yeah, that law is also applicable to mortgages. A lot of people don't know that, and they haven't changed that law for about 40 years. So is it going to be changed? Who knows? If that's your strategy and that's what your thought process is, it's probably not. I'm just going to tell you it's not a good strategy.
Right. I wouldn't be betting against the government to help you out.
Exactly. Now, there's another type of program that I already brought up, public service loan forgiveness.
Right.
And the acronym for that is PSLF. You might have heard that term floated around. PSLF, again, is not actually a loan, and it's not even a repayment plan. It's actually just a program that the government has. You have to be on an income-driven repayment plan in order to qualify for that. And then you go to work for a nonprofit or a government agency, and what they say is at the end of 10 years, everything is forgiven. You don't owe taxes, nothing. And that's why I was saying, if you have taken out a lot of loans. If you strategize correctly and you go to work for a nonprofit for 10 years, financially you can set yourself up to be in a great position. But the one takeaway from all these different programs that they have, let it be, you know, IDR or PSLF or any of these things, you have to strategize, because if you misuse them, they will really come back to haunt you.
And so, and then you just wasted 10 years working at somewhere, maybe. Yes. And the thing I hear is you work 10 years for a nonprofit. Everybody loves nonprofits. They tend to do good things. But if that's not what you want to do, then that's just not a viable option, right? This unicorn is just not for you. And you might wind up suffering or working there for 10 years, not loving it. And that sucks.
Yeah, and the other major works too. Say you are a student and you're saying, okay, I'm a first year. I'm planning on doing PSLF when I graduate. First of all, the first loan that went into that type of program was in 2007 underneath President Bush, in October 2007. So no one's qualified for it yet.
Oh, wow, the first 10 years.
Yeah, the first one is in 2017. It's next year, next October. Congress is already talking about, we messed up on this. Oh, it's going to cost us a lot of money. So they're probably going to end up changing the laws. So as a first-year student, if you're already planning on PSLF, by the time you get there,
it might not be.
It may change. Yeah. And not only that, but if you've already graduated and you're on PSLF, like you said, life happens. Maybe you are working for a nonprofit. Maybe you have a child and you decide, I don't want to work, you know, for the next 2 years. Well, it has to be 10 years full-time work. They define as 30 hours. If you decide, well, I'm going to stay at home for 2 years, that's two more years you have to make
clock,
up.
Clock wasn't running for those 2 years.
Exactly. So again, these aren't, you know, major issues like, oh my God, I'm not going to be able to do this. It's things that you need to think about when you're developing a strategy and to say, okay, I know this. I know what can happen to this. There's some uncertainty, but I understand that. And then developing a strategy to say, okay, I'm going to go that route. But if that happens, I can go this way, or I can go this way, and have that plan already set up. So if it does happen, you're not stressing out and freaking out like, oh my God, what's going to happen now? You're prepared for it. And that's the key thing, is when you strategize and set that up, you're prepared.
So we had something in the news which actually led us to finding you, which was RC-11. Yep. which is what was brought up in the House of Delegates not long ago. We had Rachel German on the show, who now winds up working for the podcast because she's so passionate about it. She connected us. How do you think something like RC-11 is going to wind up helping students, or is it just is it another unicorn?
I think it will help students. I was actually really excited when I saw RC-11, going back to like the whole conclave thing, and I thought two people were going to be in the classroom and the room was packed.
Right, and just to catch people up, RC-11 was brought forth in the House of Delegates as a motion to say the APTA, the governing body of physical therapy, should look into strategies to lower student debt and student costs. So at least we're having a conversation about it at the biggest level within the profession. You wound up being asked by a student group in California, the California Student Conclave, to come and talk to this. So it's being talked about. It's not being swept under the rug, which is what I wound up doing for the last 3 years. I'm like, eventually I'll just deal with it. But now that time has now come.
I'm excited because it shows that students are actually thinking about it.
Right.
They're saying, look, this is a problem and we're not waiting. Now, in terms of RC-11, different pieces of it being implemented and whatnot, there's some pieces that will be implemented that I feel more quickly than others. So, for example, there's a piece in there about refinancing. I mean, it's pretty easy to go out and plug in companies that offer refinancing. The problem with that is not everybody's going to qualify. Of course, there's pros and cons on that too, going federal to private, so on and so forth. The other components of it, like the education component, which like we've talked to the APTA a little bit about implementing some of our technologies, that might take a little bit longer in terms of the education, because how does that framework look? How do you wrap it into the curriculum, first of all? Do you put it out there for prospective and current students? What does that actual program look like?
I mean, something similar is they do it in the NFL, which is the other way, because they walk in saying, you just signed a deal with the signing bonus and you need to be responsible about your money because you could wind up being poor, you know, 10 years after you're done playing. It's the other way, where they're saying you're going to be poor, but here's ways that you could be less poor and maybe get back into the black a little bit faster. But similar, but just the opposite direction. It should be at least brought up at some point. And I know we have to pass those little tutorials to get some of the federal loans. We have to take those little Q&As. But I'll be honest with you, I blew through those pretty quick too.
Yeah, they don't really do anything.
No, they don't really do anything.
I'm glad that you brought up the topic of like the NFL, because that goes to show you it's just not a DPT thing. I'm a millennial myself, so our entire generation, we don't have any type of any financial literacy, anything growing up. It's not in schools, it's not anything, but it's literally just sign and let's go. Sign the doc, let's go. And then, okay, now I get a check and you get something from your loan servicer. Oh, you might qualify for a lower payment. Okay, sign here. And that's it. So that education piece, maybe take a little bit while to implement. The studying pieces of debt implications on the industry, there is actually a lot of studies, not specific to the PT industry, but just in general. So a lot of that data is already available. You know, somebody asked me, do I feel if PT prices are, you know, school prices and tuition prices are accurately priced? If you just look at it in that framework, I'd say yes, just because of the incremental return that you get in your income from it. I'm not going to go down that route because that's a really boring mathematical conversation.
Right, right.
You know, it's the overall education that you have to think about too, because you have to factor in your undergrad into that. So that's the thought process. Now, the one thing that I will talk about on RC 11 that I think is instrumental is, like you brought up, Rachel. You know, this group of students have done a great job of bringing this to the forefront of the APTA and to the PT community of, we need a solution for this. And I've seen this before in the past because I used to work for a university as well. So I've seen different things like this come up. Students bring it to the academics or the people in charge and they say, great, that's something that we need to look into. And then those students graduate.
Right.
And then they start a real life and they start working. It's up to the next students to pick up that baton and keep it going. Because if that doesn't happen, just naturally, if I was working, you know, as a corporation and this was brought to me, all of a sudden it wasn't in front of my face, I just think it's not important anymore.
Right, you'd move
and
on.
So I stopped thinking about it. When it comes to RC 11, I would really recommend, you know, students, you know, really look at how they can get involved to keep that going. I know Rachel, she's published an article on one of our sites about how to get into the House of Delegates. I mean, I would strongly recommend picking up that baton and keeping it going so that way it doesn't fall by the wayside. So
yeah, we'll put up the link to that and everything else Joe here is talking about, including a link to your website with your company. And I want to talk a little bit about what you guys do. The website is fitbux.com. That's FITBUX.com. So what do you do? Who do you work with? If someone came to you and they're about to go into grad school, is that someone who might be someone who's going to work with you? Is a current student or someone who just graduated? Or who's working with you and what do you do?
All of the above. Okay. Everything that we do centers around our technology. And that is what we call the Fitbux score. When you're going into PT school, what you're doing is increasing what we call in the finance industry, this thing called human capital. Basically what that means is, say you have your undergrad, you're making $50,000 a year. You go to PT school, then when you graduate, you're going to be making 70 grand a year. That extra $20,000 is basically what we call human capital increases in the finance industry. So from there, we can say, okay, well, this is your income based on your profession. This is the risk around that income. And that's pretty much where the finance industry typically stops. Okay. Then they basically just look at your assets and debt. And did you pay this stuff down? And you know, that's all they look at. Well, that human capital continues to play a role because it's who you are. So things like, okay, well, the average person coming out of PT school might make 70,000. Well, if you're basing your strategy on that average, you're going to get a false number because are you below or above
right.
that average?
Right.
So things like you do. So things like joining the House of Delegates, leadership skills, GPA, do you have a podcast and, you know, go in and do stuff for the industry?
Right.
These are all character builders, and this is what gets captured in human capital.
So you're putting this into some sort of algorithm, or you're giving,
yeah,
you're assigning these things, yes, points?
Yeah, we have different studies that show different results. So, for example, I'll give you one that we just looked at in the report that we were looking at. If you worked your senior year in high school, on average, 10 years, within a decade, 10 years after, so at 28 years old, you make 20% more in income than your peers.
And you're looking at that saying, if someone's got enough hustle and enough to work while you're in high school and you could be coasting, you're probably going to be doing something better a decade after.
Exactly. Another one, but like leadership skills. Did you take a role in the House of Delegates and take that leadership? Did you start a company like a Pinecast and take that leadership on? Why? Because that's important to employers. So when you're going out there and looking at jobs or whatnot, or even if you're going to apply for residencies or fellowships, they're looking at that stuff because businesses want leaders.
They want somebody who's going to be setting themselves apart.
And that speaks to your future income levels. It speaks to the risk. And in PTs, you might not be saying, okay, well, you know, we're going to make $70,000 and it's going to, you know, grow, our wages are going to grow by X percentage. But to take it to the other extreme, I always give the example of, like, if you look at a real estate agent where there's commission based and their income's all over the place, that human capital component dictates how you pay off your loans, how you save for retirement. Do you need things like life insurance to protect your family? All these things center around you, which is your human capital. So at the root of it, that's what our technology is doing. And what we're rolling out right now is what we call what-if scenarios. So like you brought up prospective and current students. What we do is we have someone build out their profile, and this one's actually in alpha testing right now. We're hoping to be rolling it out in about 2 weeks to beta test it with people. We take a look at your profile, who you are, all that human capital, and where you're at today. And we can literally show you, okay, your FitBlock score is, let's call it a 500. If you get your DPT with zero debt, your score when you graduate will be a 750. And this is what this means to your financial future. And then we can show an entire spectrum from $0 in debt all the way through to $350,000 in debt. And you can see your score dropping to a point where it's like, okay, I'm a 500 now. If I get this much debt, that means I'm a 450. I should probably not take more than that. And it's a cumulative amount as well. It's your undergrad, your graduate studies, everything involved. And then we also show you, like, the biggest thing is, well, when I graduate, how much am I going to have to pay from my income to pay these loans off?
Right.
And if I am going to take more debt, what can I start to do in developing strategy? So that is the technology that we're rolling out on that component. The other one that we actually are beta testing right now is for people that just graduated. If you're going to prepay your loans, what are the different strategies available to you? And then we can simply show you by saying this is their increase in your score, which strategy based on, you know, what inputs you put in is the best strategy for you. And it also serves for a beginning of a conversation, because then we can say, okay, this is this route, this is this route, why this one's a greater score. However, after talking to you, you might want to go with the other route because there's other qualitative factors that play into it as well, is around you. So that's the technology component.
It's pretty much like you guys took the score table from Match.com and looked at this thing I like now, it's human capital. And you said, here's your situation, you got the financials to plug in, and then you can give people options or the best strategy to take to maximize their dollar once they start making a dollar.
Yeah, it's actually funny that you brought up Match.com. My buddy's a CFO for a dating site, and they're already talking about licensing the score for their site for a matchmaking type of deal. But yeah, that's exactly what we're doing on the technology side. And the plan is to always keep that free. And eventually what we want to do is actually tie it into real time. So that way you can, once you graduate, you can connect your accounts and like your bank accounts, your debt accounts, everything. And you can literally go on there and continue to monitor it. Say, okay, well, say I graduated now, but now I got married and I have a child. Okay, well, do I need life insurance? And you can literally click a button and it tells you this is how much you need and this is how much it would increase your financial score.
And it's just using algorithms and stuff that already exist and just kind of plugging them in together with that thing called human capital. And there's a lot of pieces of the puzzle, a lot of moving parts.
Yeah, they don't already exist. I created most of the algorithm with one of our other analysts here. His name is Edmund Lau. What we've done is we took a lot of different financial concepts that are out there already. Different things, like I'm sure we'll talk today about the ever so famous new debt to income ratio that, you know, RC11 was talking about as well. We take a lot of those different ratios and start saying, okay, well, based on your age, based on the, you know, your profession, this is, you know, where you should be and this is where you're at. So we take a lot of those different studies and we've customized it to say and apply it to each person, and then we go from there. So that's the technology side. But what that technology really enables us to do is now create really innovative financial products. For example, one of the ones that we're doing and we're testing it right now is what's called an income share agreement. And so what we do is we say, okay, Jimmy, we believe your human capital, you're like, if you go to school, that human capital is going to be, it's good. It's a good investment. So we're going to invest alongside with you. So we're going to give you the money to go. And then when you graduate, you just pay us back a percentage of your income for X amount of years. So a lot of people will say, well, how is that different than the income driven repayment plans you just talked about with the government? It's not a loan. That's the major difference. With the government, like we already talked about, there's a balance, there's interest accruing.
Which is the big, the juice is the tough part, right? I mean, that's the part that keeps growing and you can't pay down the principal.
Exactly. With an income share agreement, there is no principal. There is no interest.
Sounds a little bit like a bet. Like you're saying, all right, we got this kid who's coming out of undergrad. Yeah. He's pretty solid. He worked his senior year of high school. He had a paper route all through his whole life. We're going to bet on this kid saying he's going to make X, and we want, 8% of whatever X is for 10 years. Are you willing to take that bet?
Yes, and at the end of the day, either if you are successful, then we end up making our investment return. If you're not, and that's the risk we take it with you. If you don't end up making what we think you're going to end up making, we don't make, that less. Much money either. Wow. Yeah, and so what we do is we say, say it's a 10-year term, 120 monthly payments. At the end of the 120 months, whatever it is, it's over. Okay. Whatever you paid us, it's done.
What is that thing called again? I've never heard
it's
of it.
It's called an income share agreement, and there's a number of versions. They've been around for actually about 40 years in different versions. Ours is primarily different because in a typical income share agreement, the reason why they haven't take hold is because there's no cap. Meaning if your income goes through the roof, you're going to pay through the roof too. Right. So it's kind of a turnoff to go into it. So what we've done is we put a cap on it. And so ours is drastically different than what's been out there in the past. And we cap it based on a rate of return. So if we say, look, Jimmy, I'm going to give you some money. Once I get a 6% return, the contract's over. So if we give you $10,000 and in a year from now, you want to write us a check for $10,600, doesn't even matter what your income's over. Wow. Contract's over, you're done. So we're testing that one right now. We're actually, our goal is to go into current students, but right now we can't just simply because we're a startup company. So we are doing it with recent grads and refinancing a portion of their debt to test the product out.
I mean, you brought up in your intro, I brought up that your wife was a PT. So you had your piece of the puzzle. You connected two dots, which is kind of like what I did. I was in radio and I went to PT and I connected two things that shouldn't necessarily be connected. Your wife is a PT and you're the finance guy and you're like, how can I plug my thing into your field and solve some problems? Because that's ultimately what a finance person is supposed to do, right? Solve a problem.
Exactly. And when we were drafting it out, the company and where we can implement it, we narrowed it down to about 5 or 6 industries. And at that time, my wife was going through getting her fellowship. I started looking at the product, and the more I started talking to some of the guys in the fellowship, it's like, this is actually perfect to fund the fellowship. If something costs like 10 grand, I can't get a loan. I can't get a student loan for a residency or a fellowship program, but I can get an income share agreement and possibility. So we've actually been talking to a couple different programs in terms of potentially testing the income share agreement with a residency or a fellowship program and the understanding of the industry.
Yeah, so. You had knowledge of it, so it's good to go into. Go with what you know. So students, after we graduate, I did my graduation back in May, and then my school actually ends on a clinical rotation. So we did pomp and circumstance already. Mom and dad already came to town, but then we go out for 12 more weeks. So it's going to be really anticlimactic on August 5th when it's my last day. And got to start paying stuff back. So after you graduate with student loans, when do I actually have to start paying these things back? What's the grace period? What are my options? Do I have any?
So the grace period is typically 6 to 12 months. Most of the loans nowadays are 6 months out. So you have 6 months. However, this is one of the things that I always share with students because a lot of them don't realize this. Going back to when you are actually a student, those loans just don't disappear until you graduate. Right. They're deferring. So the balance is continuing to grow. Not only that, a lot of people don't realize it, but when you actually take out a loan, like a grad plus loan, they're already charging you over 4% just to take it out in fees. So like if you took out 100 grand in grad plus loans, it's already at $104,000 day one. Wow. If your strategy while you are a student is to pay it off as fast as possible when you get out of school, start making payments while you're in school because it'll accrue less. And that applies too when you get out of school.
For that grace period, start doing
Yeah, exactly. And so, but the first thing you have to do when you graduate is you don't want to put yourself in a really bad financial situation. So if you don't have any cash at all, you still need to start developing a little bit of cash base. And we call that a reserve account in the finance industry. Basically what that is, quote unquote, a rainy day fund. So if something happens, you don't have to panic or take out a payday loan or anything like that. And so typically what we do is we say, okay, well, if you add up all your expenses, like your absolute necessities, so like utilities and food and all that good stuff, say that comes out to $1,000 a month. You just multiply that out and say, okay, well, I want a 3-month reserve. And so that means I need to have $3,000 in cash. So the first thing that you do is you need to set up that $3,000 in cash. And then from there, if you decide, okay, I'm going to start paying down my loans because that's the strategy that I'm going. You start paying them down. If you're going to decide to go on one of the income-driven plans because that's a better strategy for you, you don't want to pay it down. You want to try to maximize as much as you're saving. That reserve account, people are like, well, how much should I have? Again, it all depends on your risk profile. You know yourself better than anybody else.
Right.
So we say typically it's a 3 month reserve to a 12 month reserve. 3 being more aggressive, 12 being really, really, really conservative. You know, as a PT, you have a very steady stream of income, low unemployment. If somebody came to me and said, I'm just going to have a 3 month reserve account, I'd probably say that's fine.
Because you know there's enough jobs out there where I'm probably not going to be unemployed. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, if there's like a major recession, you don't have to worry about losing your job.
Right. Because PT's people are going to go away.
Yeah, you're going to come to PT. People are going to come to PT. You're going to have a job. So your job's not tremendously at risk. You know, and if you have to move, like if you get married and your spouse, you got a great job somewhere and you have to move, chances are when you move to that new city, you're going to find a PT job. So there's not a lot of risk. So 3 months is okay. You know, typically we see about 6 months. The first thing when you graduate is develop that amount. Just know, though, that while you're in your grace period, your loans are going to defer. So you continue to accrue interest.
Right.
Some people will say, now that I have my reserve account established and I want to start making payments, what do I pay first? You want to pay down your unsubsidized loans first, because your subsidized loans, while they are in deferral, don't accrue interest. So that's basically free money while you're not paying. Just leave it. You don't want to do anything with that. And you don't have a choice at that time, because you have to pay down any accrued interest that is accrued on the loans. And then at that point, after the 6 months, you enter in your typical repayment, and that's when you get the big knock on the door saying, this is how much you owe.
Off we go into the real world they keep talking about. So people can check out your website. People can start to play around with the technology available. And we've got some questions coming up, too. Want to make sure you can reach Joe online. He's on Twitter, which is at FitBucksOfficial, at F-I-T-B-U-X official. And the website is FitBucks.com. That's F-I-T-B-U-X.com. And we open this up for a Q and Brew. We got a few questions. Students and new grads and a bunch of PTs who've been in the clinic for a while. This is a topic that they are definitely the ears perk up when they hear about it. So we're going to take a quick break, come back in 60 seconds, and we'll get into some Q&A with Joe Reinke of FitBucks on the PT Pinecast. Don't move.
We talk PT, drink beer, and record it. This is the PT Pinecast.
PT Final Exam is an awesome resource for students preparing to take the National Physical Therapy Exam. 6 week online review courses with live webinars, personal attention from instructors through email, phone, or Skype, and practice tests. Choose from their Mastermind Study Group or the NPTE Home Study Bundle. Visit them online at ptfinalexam.com/pintcast. That's ptfinalexam.com/pintcast.
The PT Pinecast proudly supports the Wounded Warrior Project. Since 2003, the Wounded Warrior Project has been raising funds and awareness for the needs of injured service members, helping injured servicemen and women with aid and assistance, and to provide unique direct programs and services to meet their needs. Their continuing goal is to foster the most successful, well-adjusted generation of wounded service members in our nation's history. To find out how you can help the Wounded Warrior Project, visit them online at woundedwarriorproject.org. Working out his orbicularis oris until failure. DJ, Jimmy McKay on the PT Pinecast.
All right, we're back at the PT Pinecast. We are here with Joseph Reinke of FitBucks. Find him online at FitBucks.com. That's F-I-T-B-U-X.com or on Twitter at FitBucksOfficial. And wife's a PT. What kind? How'd you meet? What's the deal there? What's the score?
My wife's an orthopedic outpatient. She works for a hospital out here in California. It's Kaiser. So she actually went to Boston University before coming out here. And I actually met her through my other background besides finance, which I was an athlete. I played baseball and I played ice hockey. Between my junior and senior year in high school, I destroyed my shoulder. You know, I was like, baseball's done. And so for years, I kept putting off the surgery, putting it off. And my hands started going numb. I started losing feeling. So I was like, I really have to, you know, check out what's going on with this shoulder. And, you know, the doctor comes in and is like, you have to have the surgery. And I was like, well, why? It doesn't hurt anymore. It's so torn and messed up. He's like, you won't be able to pick up your kid by the time you're 35 years old. And I was like, okay, I have one condition. I'm this jerk athlete that, you know, thinks that I need PT and treatment every single day and I need the best PT and blah, 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 blah. So he's like, look, you know, I understand your concern. We'll put you with a really good PT. And if you don't like her after about a month, you can go ahead and tell us, hey, So the first day I go to PT, the person's like 25 or 26 years old. And I'm just like, oh, okay, she looks young, but maybe she has a lot of experience. So I go through PT. About a year later, I actually end up finding out that I wasn't supposed to see that PT. I was actually supposed to see Stefania Bell.
Oh, yeah, and, from ESPN.
Yes, and that's why I didn't see her, because a couple weeks after I started my rehab, she was going to ESPN. So I ended up seeing her mentee instead. And I found out that story because I ended up marrying that PT.
You married your PT.
Yes. She ended up telling me about, oh, I was supposed to see Stefania and whatnot. And she always jokes around. She's like, if you ever tell that story to other PTs, just make sure that you clarify that I didn't ask you out until after you were discharged. Like, I didn't break any laws or anything. I was like, okay.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so good things, you know, I guess. I destroyed my shoulder and it led me to meeting my wife. So
yeah, that's cool. And it's full circle because we just had Stefania on the show not too long ago. That's cool.
Yep.
All right, so we're going to do a brew and cue. This is something we like to do, is open it up on Twitter, and you can follow us online at PT Pinecast and check out the blogs and any of the links that we mentioned during a show. You can find out afterwards with an episode chaser at the blog section of ptpinecast.com. So we put this out a while ago and got a bunch of questions. People really wanted to get in depth with you and be able to fire some things out at you, which shows you that this is an area in PT that needs to be addressed, or should it be addressed more, which is being able to ask these questions, because we lack this knowledge. I think we're kind of illiterate in terms of finance. So first question up comes from Ryan Hammack. He is on Twitter at Phoenix Manual. Does anybody have any good data on average student loan amounts for graduating DPTs and PTAs? So do you have a ballpark, or what's the average of people who are coming out? Because I mentioned how much I had in loans, and I had a current PT who's been out in the field for more than 15 years say that is abnormally high, and then a bunch of my fellow PT students came in and said that's average or low. So what do you have on terms of average student loan amount?
Based on the data that we've collected, what we've been able to pinpoint it to is somewhere between $115,000 and $125,000.
Wow.
So if you want to put that in the midpoint, about $120,000, and that's not an average, that's about the median. And so that's what we use just when we're looking at different numbers, is about $120,000.
So when you mentioned earlier about, you know, is the juice worth the squeeze, you know, is the return on investment, when you look at that and you say someone's going to start and make what? What's the average starting salary? Around 70-something national average?
About 70. Yep, 65 to 70.
So as somebody who's a pure finance guy, is that a good bet to make, knowing you're going to come out with that debt and make this as an average? Is the juice worth the squeeze there?
If you're only looking at the cost of DPT school, and I'm not even talking about debt. I mean, you can finance it with cash too. So if this thing costs $120,000, my return, like we talked about earlier, went from $50,000 a year in salary to $70,000. So I got an incremental return of $20,000,
right?
But if you say you're going to work for 30 years, that's $600,000 in benefit. That costs you $120,000. So on a return basis, yes. Unfortunately, there's other things that get involved in that, like how much undergrad debt did you have as well? What if you're above the 150, 180, 200? And then I get the question, well, are you telling me I could take out $350,000 and finance my education? The answer is no. That's not correct. The reason being is we want to be able to take advantage of that human capital that we created and that extra $20,000. Paying off your debt is different for student loans than something like a home loan.
Why?
You know, and I get that question too, like you just said, why?
Yeah, I don't get it.
I could finance $600,000 in a house, right? Why can't I do that with my education? Let's just say you're on a 25-year repayment plan for your student loan, okay? And you're using that human capital, and you're going to work for 30 years. Well, after 25 years, you've paid down your debt, and you only have 5 years of working. You don't have any asset left to show for it.
Right.
You don't really get any return from that. Whereas when you're paying down a house, you pay for 25 or 30 years, and at the end of that time, you still have an asset. You can liquidate your house.
Okay.
So there's a major difference, and that human capital asset is different because we build it today, but we realize it in our income each year. And so it's not something that we get today. And it's how we use that income now. The key financial strategy is I built my human capital. I have to now transition that into financial capital. And if you're spending all that on debt, you're going to be behind the eight ball for a long time. So that's why there's a cap on how much you should borrow in terms of financing your education.
Okay, I can see that. Next question comes from Twitter at PTA Perspective. His name is Chris Beaver. What does the average monthly debt payment come out to? Is this something you even know? He said he heard about $1,000 a month. Is that unheard of, is his question.
So using that $120,000 number that I gave on a standard federal loan of 10 years, just assuming a 6% interest rate on all your loans, it comes out to $1,332 a month. So is $1,000 unheard of? No. Not at all. If you stretch it out and say, well, what about a 20-year loan? It's about $859 a month. Is $1,000 a month unheard of? No, absolutely not. It's actually pretty common if you're on a 10-year loan.
Okay. Demir Jones, SPT, wants to know, what's the ideal method of paying off student debt? Is this a really, really personal question because everything's different? He wanted to know about time, amount, et cetera, to pay it off.
It is very personal when you get into that customized strategy, just because everybody's a little bit different. However, there are some generalities to follow. What we talk about in the industry, and if you read a lot of some of the RC 11 articles and whatnot, you hear this term flown around, debt to income ratio. Mm-hmm. But what is that? How do I calculate this? Basically what it is you just take your monthly income, or what percentage of your income is going towards your monthly payments. So if I'm making $10,000 a month and my payment is $1,000, it's a 10% DTI ratio. The general rule of thumb in the industry, and you know, if you're driving, pull over, or you know, you're next to an open window in a tall building, you know, don't jump out, is about 10 to 15%, okay, of your income should be going to your student loan. So to give you an example, on that average that I gave, where it was $120,000 or $1,300 a month in a payment, at that typical PT starting salary, that actually comes out to about 23%.
Wow.
Okay. You want to say about 10 to 15%. And that's actually backed by data. Like we talked about return on your investment and the human capital. That's actually one of the reasons why the federal government in their income-driven plans caps it at 10 to 15% is because they're looking at the same data that we're looking at. That's the starting point. If you're above that, again, it's not the end of the world. Like you can be at 23% and say, I'm paying this thing off over 10 years. That's fine. I just need to understand like things like saving for a house, my retirement, whatever it may be, might be hindered slightly because I'm paying this off, but that's my goal. I want to pay this off. So again, it's just customized. It's not the end of the world. It just means you might have some options that are limited at that point.
Okay. Another one from Twitter, at Ryan Haskins, SPT, wants to know, he and his wife want to pay off their loans ASAP, like you just mentioned, planning off living off her salary and just putting his all to loans. What are your thoughts? Does that make sense? Does that help?
Yeah, this is actually one of the best questions out there because it goes to a broader financial management type of perspective that you need to take, not just with your student loans, but everything. And what I mean by that is we have biases, okay, as individuals. As a single person, what I mean by that oftentimes in finance is we say, okay, well, I'm going to have this money in this savings account, and I'm going to have this money in this IRA, and I'm going to have this money in this 401k, and we bucket our money, and we shouldn't. And it's all one big bucket.
Right.
And when you're married, that's even hyped up even more. And I see it way too often where people are like, well, I make $100,000 and my wife makes $50,000 and I pay for this and she pays for that and we save this. And it's like, no, you both combined make $150,000. So you need to strategize together and how you can most efficiently pay this down. And oftentimes that relates to something like who has the better 401k match? Like if you're going to pay this out of you know, your income to pay down your loans aggressively, and that means you're not going to put any money in your 401k, but your employer matches 7%,
right,
and your spouse
7%, right?
Yeah, you're losing money at that point. So you have to strategize around that. This is why that previous question I was saying, it is all customized. Okay, that $120,000. Yeah, if you're making $70,000 as a PT and you're single, that's one thing. But if you're married and combined, you're making $150,000, you can aggressively pay the $120,000 down and it's not hindering anything.
Okay.
And we see that a lot. Married couples, do you have other expenses like children and mortgages? There's other factors that come into play. And that's why, again, with the Fitbox score, the technology, that's what we're actually incorporating too into this, is those other components as well.
Next is out of the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. Sarah H. wants to know, how do student loans affect her credit?
This is a double-edged sword. And there's two ways of thinking about it. As of today, right now, how is this affecting my credit? As of today, right now, it's not. So you can have $500,000 of student loan on your credit report and it's not actually affecting it. What it's doing today though, however, is if you go to get another loan for a mortgage or a car or something of that nature, it's on your credit report. So there's going to be factored into if you qualify or not for those other loans, what's the interest rate on those other loans, so on and so forth. In terms of actually my credit score, and this is why I said it's a double-edged sword.
Okay.
It can be really good. It can be really bad. As you make payments, it can really increase your credit score. If you default, obviously it's going to destroy your credit score. As of today, it just factors into how much loans you can take out and the interest rates on those loans. It also depends on your future in terms of what you're actually paying. That's the part that's going to affect your credit. The other piece that you have to be cognizant of, and I'm glad that she brought up the credit report. This is something that a lot of people don't think about on the income-driven repayment plans. If you're saying, I'm going to go on an income-driven repayment plan because I want to save for a house, it still affects your credit report. Typically, the student loan servicer factors in your regular loan payment, and that's what's being reported on your credit report. So you might not qualify for a mortgage for 20 years. So again, if that's your strategy, you need to understand that component. And we talked about earlier, by the way, about how things could change. Home qualifications for people on income-driven repayment plans in the last 12 months, the qualifications have already changed twice.
Wow.
So again, that's all part of the planning.
Okay. Loans getting deferred. They get deferred if you go back to school. Does residency and fellowship count as going to school? It's from Fallon, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee.
A couple years ago, if you asked me this, absolutely not. That is changing. Okay. So federal loans, you can only get them either actually get federal loans or get them deferred for accredited universities, basically schools that the federal government says, yes, they have our stamp of approval. Today, some residency programs are now being ran through universities. Do they actually qualify for that deferral? I do not know. There's two places that you need to go and check. One is with the actual residency program, but the number one place to go is your student loan servicer. And the reason why I say to go to your student loan servicer and ask is they are legally obliged to give you the correct information. So if they tell you, oh yeah, you can defer it, and you go and it doesn't defer, they're on the hook for it.
Gotcha.
And so you also want to say, if you go to your student loan servicer and you say, and they say, yes, it does, ask them, where can I see that in writing? So that way you know exactly where you can point to and say, this is, you know, where it's at. I always tell students, assume no until it's proven to you that, yes, it can.
You mentioned earlier the Public Loan Forgiveness Program. Does that work with undergrad and perhaps master's degree programs, or is it just a PT degree that they'll honor after 10 years?
It's just federal loans. Yeah, all federal loans. And actually, I shouldn't say all, because again, with PSLF, you have to be on an income-driven repayment plan. And each income-driven repayment plan has different loans that actually qualify for it. So for example, some of them, Perkins loans won't qualify. However, there is a workaround. The workaround is that if you actually consolidate the loan, then it again qualifies. So again, that student loan servicer would be able to sit down and tell you exactly, these are the loans that do, these are the loans that don't, and if you want that other one to qualify, this is what you have to do. But yeah, it's all federal loans. It doesn't matter undergrad. I mean, you can go and have your, you know, undergrad in whatever degree you want, psychology, get an MBA, get a, you know, a DPT, whatever it is, and it all will qualify.
An article that came out, actually written by a PT, his name is Ryan Hammack, talked about indentured servitude and the cost of physical therapy education. This just seems like something I need to bring up with you because you're in the middle of this. The crux of it was, is the juice worth the squeeze? And he brought a bunch of numbers in it, and that's when my eyes went kind of glassy, because you can throw numbers in front of me, and I'm probably going to believe you because I can't outmath people. But what do you have to say to something like that? The title was On Indentured Servitude and the Cost of Physical Therapy Education. We're going to put the link to that so you can check it out online at ptpinecast.com. What are your thoughts on that?
First and foremost, I hear those words all the time. There's a servitude, slavery, whatever you want to dress it up with. You know, I don't typically like those words because I think more of a financial terms. I mean, I'm an investor at heart, so I think, like we've already talked about, what's my return on my investment?
Right.
Is it worth it to me? At some point, the answer is no. And now you have to say, okay, well, am I doing this because of other reasons beyond financial? Like, I just really want to be a PT. Right. That's what I want to do. I want to help people, because those factors play into it as
well. I feel like most people do want to be a PT. The flaming hoops to jump through to get there make us think that, you know, we should be given something for our effort.
Exactly. And if you ask me, I think PTs should be actually paid a lot more than what they are, especially with the new Affordable Care Act, with the qualifications of being, you know, surgeries being remitted for new surgeries. I mean, it's like, hey, PTs prevent that. Like, we should be getting paid more, right? So I think PTs already should be getting paid more. But yeah, the whole indentured servitude piece, it's, you know, I see the concept behind it and I see what it means. And it goes back to that conversation we had earlier about, am I using all my human capital simply to pay off debt? Because when you do that, you're now the only person you're not benefiting is yourself in terms of wealth-wise. You're creating wealth for the school. You're creating wealth for your employer. You're creating wealth for the person you're writing a check to every month, which is the federal government. And at the end of 20 years, what do you have? you basically just made them wealthy, and that's why they say, well, you're indentured to that person. And then once you do that, then they sign you off and you can do whatever you want to. And again, to me, it's more not in terms of those wording, it's what's the return on my investment. That's the focus that what we should be thinking about. The area that even PTs and PT schools, when they talk about pricing and all that stuff, that's the concept of, okay, if we charge this much, is there still a benefit there? And that's the crux of the conversation.
Just someone who's been looking into the numbers and intimately involved with the field, do you think costs of PT programs will continue to rise? And if so, there's got to be a point when the bubble bursts, right?
Yes. I don't think it's just DPT programs. I think it's any type of advanced degrees. And it's twofold. Yeah, actually threefold. There's three players involved in it. The federal government, first and foremost, they're just writing a blank check. Right? It doesn't matter what the cost is, go. And you have students that are constantly, I mean, we've all been told since the time we're 3 years old, get an education, get an education, get an education at all costs, get an education, right? So we're going. It's like, we got accepted. You know, how do you get accepted to a school that you've been trying to get into and a program and other thing, and then turn around and be like, I can't do this because of cost? It's hard to say no to, right? But then I've also been on the university side of it. Like I said, I used to work for Long Beach State, and schools need money. And at the end of the day, it's like, well, if the government's writing the check and the demand is there, we're going to keep upping the price, right? Because we're getting it and students aren't saying no. The PT industry is actually, to be honest with you, it's been slow to catch up to the tuition increases. You look at MBA schools and some of these other categories, and they, and especially like law school, it's gone through the roof. And will that stop anytime soon? I don't know. We'll see. I could see, you know, because the government typically sells the loans to investors, and because of a lot of the income-driven plans are now, quote-unquote, not paying, investors might pull the plug on that. The difference is that the government has an unlimited amount of money.
Right.
They can print it or they can take it in the form of taxes. You know, and oftentimes that leads to people, they often ask me, how does this compare to the housing bubble in 08? Well, it's the same type of concept. It's just that third player, that government player, has unlimited money. Back in 2008, banks and investors don't have a limited amount of money. So that blew up. You know, look like in the student loan industry, and when does it stop? I don't know. And I'll stop that conversation there because then it can start getting really political.
Next one comes from MikeDPT18 on Twitter. Any difference in terms of managing payments for a student loan and doing the same with a mortgage or a car loan?
This is where you can follow one strategy that says keep it simple. And there's another strategy that says, okay, let's dig deeper. And I want to get more active in this. That keep it simple method is, I'm just going to treat all my debt the same, okay? And I'm going to look at the highest interest rate one first, and that's the one that I'm paying down the most aggressively. And then when that one's paid off, I'm going to the next one. And it doesn't matter if it's a credit card. It doesn't matter if it's student loan, mortgages, car loans. If you follow that method, you're going to end up saving the most money in the long run because you're paying the highest interest rate loan first, okay? To go deeper into that, that's a lot of people ask us about student loan strategies and how to prepay them fastest. Dave Ramsey calls it a waterfall method. But that's simply what that is. It's just pay the highest interest rate loan first and then pay off the other ones after that. The more advanced strategy is all loan is not created equal, meaning debt is not equal. So when we have things like student loans, up to a certain point in our salary, we can actually write off the interest against our taxes. Things like mortgage debt, we can write off the interest against our taxes. So if you want to get more strategic in that framework, you can then work with an accountant and figure out exactly which one will put the most money in my pocket. The second component of that is I hear a lot of financial advisors say to their clients, always pay down student loans first. And the reason being is that when you have something like a mortgage or a car loan or a personal loan, and you can't pay it, you still have one major option available to you. It's called bankruptcy. And so if you go through bankruptcy, you can wipe it off of your credit report. You can wipe it off of everything. You don't owe it anymore. Student loans are bankruptcy remote, meaning they don't go away. If you owe it, they're coming after you. And it doesn't get, and you don't have that option anymore. So a lot of financial advisors just say, focus on the student loans, get those off your plate.
Next question comes from University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Rachel asking again, how does loan consolidation work, putting them together?
So there's two terms that often get floated out, consolidation and refinancing, okay?
Yeah, I've heard those terms multiple times, and I admittedly don't really 100% know what they mean.
I'm gonna go through the two differences. Basically, a loan consolidation is if you have, say, five loans when you graduate, and they're all 10 years, and your monthly payment between all of them is $1,000, let's say. Loan consolidation, all it simply does is combine all those five loans into one loan. Your payment doesn't decrease. How much you owe over the term of the contract doesn't change. Nothing changes. The only major disadvantage on that loan consolidation is it limits your strategy that you can use. Because like I was just mentioning, paying down the highest interest rate loan first. If you're prepaying and you consolidate your loans, you no longer have that option because you only have one loan. You don't have five. So that's why you always have to be strategic before you even consolidate. Refinancing is where you would literally say, okay, I'm going to take out those five loans. I'm going to replace them all with a completely brand new loan.
So you're going to draw up new terms.
Yeah. And you can be going from a 10-year term to a 5-year term to a 15-year term to a 6% rate to a 5%, whatever it is. It's completely brand new terms. Where people get really confused at is, and we see this a lot, somebody will tell us, oh yeah, I refinanced my loan. And what they did was they actually consolidated it and they changed the term to a 20-year loan. So basically they consolidated and then moved the term and they dropped their payment because it's just a longer term. So like I refinanced and it, no, you didn't actually refinance. You just stretched out the term and you consolidated. And so that's why it gets so confusing a lot of times, is because often when we consolidate at the same time we are refinancing. Just remember, those are the two differences, is that consolidations is combining, refinancing is a new type of loan structure.
Okay. Last question. This one comes out of University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee as well. Private companies, heard they're not the way to go to pay your loans through. Is that true, false? Is there some fact or fiction?
Okay. There is fact and fiction. And I'm biased on this because I am a private company. No. It depends really on what your strategy is. I mean, if you want those federal options to you in terms of income-driven repayment plans and whatnot, once you go private, you don't have those options anymore. And you have the new terms of your new agreement. Where that really plays into play right now, excluding FitBucks and our company, for example, if you do want to go get your residency and you go to a program that does allow you to defer your loans, if you refinance into a private loan, you're not deferring. So those options might be limited. There's no public service loan, for goodness. There's none of that there. So that's the part of, okay, well, if I'm going into one of those programs and taking advantage of the federal loans, you have to analyze which one's better, going private or staying in one of those programs. Now, on the flip side of that, some people are going to say, well, I actually only borrowed 70 or 90 grand or 110 grand. I'm going to aggressively pay this down, okay? And so instead of paying it in 10 years, they might pay it in 5 years. And they're going to end up saving, let's say, $17,000 on their loans. And I'm sure we've all been driving down the street and we see these billboards. Refinance your student loans with us and you can save $20,000. Well, there's a little bit more to that, $20,000 and what they're telling you. They're going to come in and say, you can go into this type of loan or that type of loan and shorten the term and do all these different things. And that might not necessarily be the greatest idea for you. And they might come in and say, okay, well, if you shorten your term, for example, from 10 years to 5 years, we can give you this new interest rate. Compared to your 20 or your original loan, you're going to save $20,000. But when you actually do the math out, if you're just prepaying on a normal schedule, you are already paying down $17,000. So in actuality, refinancing only saved you $3,000. But what ended up happening by shortening your term is that prepayment amount that you're making, that was optionary. You don't have to make that every month. You're only required to make the payment that's stated in your contract. When you refinance to that lower term, you don't ever have that option anymore. You have to make that payment. You've just given up flexibility. So now you have to sit back and say, for this little bit of extra savings, is it worth it for me to give up that flexibility? Sometimes the answer is yes, sometimes the answer is no. And we've actually gone through with clients when they've sent in their stuff, they've sent us stuff from other companies that they're being offered. And then we walk through that exact analysis with them and say, this is how much you're actually saving by refinancing compared to what you're already doing. And I know I just threw out a lot of numbers and you don't need to know those numbers. Nothing is ever just cut and dry, just sign here.
It's too good to be true. It probably is.
Exactly. And it's like, what am I actually getting out of this and what do I need to know? And I joke around people all the time. I say, keep it simple. Finance is just a big fancy word. All it is math just applied to money. Addition and subtraction. Just keep it simple. When you understand that piece of it and you learn that little trick, it's just simple arithmetic. Life will really simplify for you.
Good advice right there. Every episode is a pint, and before we're done with pints, we do shots. Now you, I feel like, could give advice on refinancing and consolidating and loans for days, but if you had to boil it down for one parting shot of wisdom to people who are dealing with their student loans from PT school, what would that one piece of advice be?
Keep it simple and strategize.
Like it.
Develop a strategy.
Sounds good. You can find him online. You can find him on Twitter at FitBucks Official, and their website is fitbucks.com. They have some stuff out there, and sounds like you got some more stuff coming down the pipe. FITBUX.com. Joe, pleasure having you on the show. I feel a little more literate in terms of what I've got coming up to start paying off very, very shortly, so I appreciate that.
Thanks for having me.
Like what you hear? Leave us a review on iTunes. It's not like our moms can keep giving us 5 stars every day. Or can they? The PT Pinecast is intended for educational purposes only. No clinical decision-making should be based solely on one source. While care is taken to ensure accuracy, factual errors can be present. Our lawyers made us read that.